Well, I'd like to focus for a few minutes this morning on one verse in the Old Testament. It's not in the passage that we read earlier on. It's in 1 Samuel chapter 16. And it's the opening verse of that chapter. Where we read this. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons." And as we look then at this verse this morning, I would like to draw your attention to three things, and I'd like to do so working backwards through the verse, so from the end of it to the beginning of it. So the first thing I'd like us to notice then is God's mission. That's our first heading this morning, God's mission. So at the end of this verse then, we have God saying to Samuel, "I have provided a king." Now those five words make sense in the context. Israel needs a new king. Saul is presently Israel's king. He's the first king of Israel. But he's going from bad to worse. He's kind of unraveling before the eyes of the reader of 1 Samuel. A replacement for Saul is clearly required. And so, as I say, those five words make sense. I have provided a king. The only problem is, those five words are actually a misquotation of the verse on my part, because the verse doesn't end, does it? "I have provided a king." No, it ends, "I have provided for myself a king." That's what God actually says to Samuel. And that doesn't seem to make as much sense then. Surely it's Israel that needs a king. It's not God that needs a king. Why on earth does God need a king? Do we need to change the preposition here? Should we read it rather, "I have provided by myself a king"? Is that really what the verse is saying? Or should we be as high-handed as the NIV translators are and just omit the phrase altogether, omit the "for myself" bit of the verse? What should we do with this puzzling, awkward couple of words in the middle of this statement God makes to Samuel? Well, I think that the "for me" or "for myself" bit of this statement is actually very important. It kind of lifts us out of the little story of Israel and its particular needs in 1000 BC. And it kind of transports us, I think, into a bigger story. A bigger story within which actually Israel's entire history is merely one contributing chapter. A story which began way before there even was an Israel. A story which began with God creating a pristine and perfect universe, a world of goodness and beauty for his own enjoyment and glory. That's the starting point of this bigger story I'm talking about. But there was an early and dramatic twist in this bigger story. Not long after God had made this beautiful, perfect world, a vicious enemy, Satan, emerged within the new universe, hating the Creator and desiring with all his heart to ruin God's creation. This he managed to do by targeting and ensnaring the very noblest component of God's creation, man, that creature that God had made as his own image bearer. He had made him climactically at the end of the whole creation process. Satan cunningly targeted man and turned man against his maker, and by so doing plunged God's creation into chaos and disarray. But the story moved on from that point. And hard on the heels then of that disaster, God confronted his enemy who had just ruined his creation. And his tone as he confronted him wasn't deflated and resigned. It was combative and threatening. Satan's triumph, God indicated, wasn't going to last. God would get his creation back. God would vanquish the vile intruder and would once again derive enjoyment and glory from his world. That would be the mission that God would be on from now on. And he would accomplish this mission through a kingly, conquering figure who, he said, would crush Satan's head. That is the biggest story, I'm saying, undergirding all the Bible's little stories. And it's that story then that this phrase here in 1 Samuel 16:1 briefly reconnects us with. This idea of God providing a king for himself, it makes perfect sense in that broader context. It's exactly what the earliest chapters of the Bible lead us to expect would happen. God providing a king to destroy his own enemy and win back his own creation with a view to his own enjoyment and glory. I just want to pause there then for a moment. Perhaps this morning you're not a Christian. Perhaps you have this idea in your head of Christianity's God. And that the God of Christianity then is basically this fairy godmother kind of figure. He just stands on the sidelines of Christians' lives and kind of helps them along a bit in their lives and answers their prayers for them and all that kind of stuff. He's there for the struggling believer in his or her time of need. And that's more or less how Christianity works then. Perhaps that's the idea you have, and you find that idea, frankly, rather silly and pathetic and perhaps even a little cowardly. Why, you say, can't Christians just face up to the harsh realities of this world like everyone else does? Why do they have to lean on this God crutch kind of thing that they seem to have? Perhaps that's your conception. Well, if so, please allow me to disabuse you of that idea this morning. Because that is unrecognizable from what we find in this book, the Scriptures. The God of the Bible isn't some amenable little deity existing for man's benefit and at man's service. The God of the Bible is huge. Everything revolves around him. Paul says that from him and through him and to him are all things. The story of history, indeed the story of the universe, isn't about man. Man is just a footnote in it. It's about God and his concerns. The loss which he incurred on that day that Satan struck, and the epic mission that he is now on to redress that personal loss. That's what it's all about. And a Christian then isn't someone who has enlisted God's help in his or her life. Now, a Christian is someone who has recognized that a God colossal enough to dominate the whole story of the universe is a God before whom we must bow in self-surrendering worship. That's biblical Christianity. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15:28 that the great omega point to which everything is heading is a day when he says God will be all in all. His sovereignty unchallenged, his purposes unresisted, his glory undimmed. That's the goal, that's the destination, that's the climax to which everything is slowly building. And the Christian then is simply someone who, in the face of that grand, epic, divine mission, says, yes, amen, so let it be. May that day come when God indeed is all in all. That's what a Christian is. So that's the first thing this morning. I wanted us to notice God's mission, but then notice, secondly, God's means. God's means. How is he going to provide himself? Provide himself, remember the importance of that. How is he going to provide himself a king? From what prestigious background will this devil-conquering, universe-restoring king emerge? From what eminent city, from what distinguished family, where will Samuel have to go on this quest to find him? Well, move back then to the middle part of our verse, where we have God saying to Samuel, fill your horn with oil and go. That's what he says. And this then is where Samuel has to go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons. So it's from no eminent city that God's king will emerge. It's from Bethlehem. If you go out along the A69, you go past Hexham, of course, just to the south of the 69, and just beyond Hexham, you can turn off to the north on the road that takes you toward Kielder. And after a few miles, you'll come to a village called Wall. And really, that name tells you pretty much everything you need to know about that village. Hadrian's Wall is there, and not really all that much else. And it was the same with Bethlehem. Bethlehem means house of bread. It's a reference to barley production. And again, that name then really tells you everything that you need to know about Bethlehem. Okay, barley production is perhaps slightly too specific, but if you broaden that to farming, then certainly you've got the place summed up. You've comprehensively summarized Bethlehem. I mean, all Bethlehem's best known appearances in the Bible involve farming, don't they? Whether Ruth in the harvest fields, or David tending the sheep when Samuel turns up to anoint the new king, or the shepherds watching their flocks by night. This is really what Bethlehem was. It was just a small farming place. It wasn't situated on the coast with associated trading possibilities. It wasn't situated near some precious natural resource with associated industrial possibilities. It was just a rural backwater. Too little, Micah will later say. Too little to be among the clans of Judah. In other words, too insignificant to have its own discrete subdivision of the tribe of Judah. Likely, we sang in our hymn about Bethlehem being this sleepy, uneventful little town. And it's from there then, from there, God says, that his king will come. It's from no eminent city, and nor then is it from any distinguished family, from among Jesse's sons. It's interesting that when Israel's first king was appointed, Saul, we are introduced in chapter 9 of this book, chapter 9 verse 1, to Saul's father, Kish. And we're specifically told that Kish was a man of wealth. We have no such comment here now in 1 Samuel 16:1 regarding Jesse. And that omission suggests, I think, that Jesse occupies quite a different position on the social ladder from Kish, a much lower position. While Kish prospers, while Kish has young servant men at his disposal, we are specifically told, Jesse is what Theresa May would call a jam, at just about managing. And it's from him then, from his loins, from his home, from his family, that God's king will come. Now we need to ask at this point then, well, who is this king? Who is this king that God is providing for himself? Well, the answer is Jesus. He's the son of Jesse the Bethlehemite. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, Isaiah will later say, describing Jesus. He's the king God has provided for himself to crush his enemies and reclaim his creation. Now you might be thinking, but hang on a minute. It's not Jesus that Samuel trots off to anoint with oil here in 1 Samuel 16. And that's true, it's not. It's a much earlier son of Jesse. It's David, of course. And David then functions as a very helpful visual aid. If you like, he is Jesus in miniature. As I set out the other Wednesday evening, I think in his very first act, once he has been anointed, the toppling of Goliath, he vividly, graphically anticipates Jesus. So being sent to Bethlehem then a millennium early, if you like, isn't Samuel being sent on a wild goose chase here? No, in a provisional, preparatory sense, David is the king God has provided for himself. But I'm saying the full meaning of these words won't be satisfied until much later on, throughout December. The child looks at the stocking hanging from the mantelpiece and can't wait then until the morning when its material will no longer be all limp and floppy, but it will be bulging and it will be stretched to its limits because it's full of presents. And this phrase of God's here, I have provided for myself a king, it's a bit like a stocking. And with David's emergence then, it assumes a bitter shape. There's an orange now in the bottom, if you like. But only it will only bulge, it will only be stretched to its limits as Jesus emerges on that night when the angels will sing. So, if Jesus is the king then, this text is pointing us, isn't it, to a huge paradox. I mean, that story that I briefly outlined to you in my first heading this morning, this big story, as I call it, of the Bible, it's such a grand story, isn't it? And this king then that God provides for himself, he has such a grand role. He will carry out that ancient threat to Satan in the Garden of Eden. He will undo that strike against God that took place that day. There's no other role performed by anyone else in the whole of history that can even compare with the role that this figure performs. And yet... he emerges from this family in this place. And Jesse's family hasn't climbed up the social ladder a few rungs by the time we get to Jesus' emergence. No, Joseph, of course, a humble carpenter in down-at-heel Nazareth. And Bethlehem hasn't become a more sophisticated, cutting-edge type of place by the time that Jesus emerges. No, its hospitality sector is embarrassingly unable to cope with an influx of people at census time. And what an incongruity then. What a paradox. This stunningly important king emerging in such stunningly unimpressive circumstances. And of course, the paradox is more acute than I have described it. Because this king, having emerged from Jesse's family and in the town of Bethlehem, his first bed will be a dirty manger. His first visitors will be lowly shepherds. His first journey will be a desperate escape from the country, fleeing from pursuing soldiers. And the paradox will only continue as he'll spend the first 30 years of his life in utter obscurity, making zero impression even on the land of Palestine, let alone on the world he's come to restore. The paradox will then ease temporarily as he starts to perform miracles and attract crowds and look a little bit more like he's someone significant. But then, of course, the ultimate paradox will occur as finally he hangs naked and tormented, a crucified outcast, deserted by friends and derided by enemies. On that execution day at Golgotha, the circumstances he's in will be a million miles removed from what you would expect of this great king sent to fulfill God's great mission. There's a story in the news back in October of a painting located in a National Trust property in Aberdeenshire. And the painting then was a Raphael-style Madonna. And in the late 19th century, this painting was classified as a copy and attributed to some minor Renaissance artist and valued at around £20. Recently, however, an historian was making a programme for the BBC and was at this property in Aberdeenshire and happened to spot this painting rotting away in some out-of-the-way corner of the house. And this guy became convinced that actually this was no copy and that this was a genuine Raphael. Now, I think the painting is right now being subjected to further expert scrutiny, but the consensus seems to be in the art world that that historian was right and that the value of that painting is closer to £20 million than to £20. Now, I'm probably just an uncultured Philistine, but stories like that make me think, well, if these great artists can potentially be copied, and copied so closely then that there could be all this confusion and the status and value of a painting can kind of lurch back and forth from £20 to £20 million, it kind of raises the question, well, are these great artists really so great after all? I mean, if people thought that some minor Renaissance artist, if people thought for centuries that he was capable of painting something that was so close to an original that actually some people think it might be an original, then why is he considered just a minor Renaissance artist anyway? Now, you art lovers can correct me afterwards, but this is my point, that when God does things, he leaves such a distinctive mark on what he does, it can only be him. He's inimitable. We sang last Sunday that all his ways are matchless, godlike, and divine. And nowhere is he more distinctive and nowhere is he more inimitable than in the execution of this Satan-slaying mission of his. The means by which he does it are so strange, so uninventable. No one else would have done it this way. No one would have made it up. No one would have written this script except God. It's so God, the script that he writes for this grand mission of his. This son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, born in squalor, raised in obscurity, crucified in disgrace. At every point, it runs entirely counter to everything that you would ever expect or predict. What a God! He's never boring, is he? Never stilted, never cliched, never stuck in a rut, never confined by the walls of a small imagination. As Paul will write, oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments and how inscrutable his ways. And once again then, shouldn't we bow down in worship this morning? Shouldn't we say with Moses, who is like you, O Lord? Who is like you? God's mission, God's means. But then thirdly and finally, notice with me, God's message. God's message. So let's keep working backwards through our verse, and we come then to the opening sentence. And there we have the Lord asking Samuel, how long will you grieve? How long will you grieve? Samuel apparently is in the depths. He's disconsolate. He's despairing. Little wonder, really, after such an exciting start to his life, that conception within a womb which for so many years had been barren, that upbringing consecrated in such an unusual way to the Lord, after a start to his life so apparently rich with potential, Samuel's life seems to have become shrouded by two major disappointments. Domestically, his sons have turned out to be corrupt and wicked men. And now nationally, this king that he had anointed and that he had sought to mentor, he has turned out a failure. What has Samuel's life achieved? What meaningful contribution has he made? What's it all been for? The answers to those questions don't look very encouraging. And so Samuel's grief then, here in our verse, is really quite understandable. But God has this message for Samuel. How long will you grieve? As a parent with young children, people sometimes ask me, what time do they get up on Christmas morning? And they're expecting me to grimace then and mention some unearthly hour that the children arise. Actually, for some reason, I don't know why, we don't drug our children on Christmas Eve or anything, but for some reason, they've never been early wakers on Christmas morning. It's never been a problem. Indeed, some Christmases, conscious of time passing and the Christmas morning service approaching, we've had to go in and wake them. And if then waking our children on Christmas morning, we were to say, how long are you going to sleep for? Those words would not have a recriminating tone, as they might do, the same words might do on an ordinary school morning. No, they would have a warm tone, wouldn't they? Forget sleeping. You don't want to sleep now. You want to see what's downstairs. You're going to love it. That's really what those words mean. And that, I think, is the tone as God addresses Samuel here. When he says, how long will you grieve? It doesn't mean stop moaning, you silly little man, pull yourself together. No, he means forget grieving, Samuel. You don't want to grieve now. You want to see this mission that I am on, providing a king for myself by the most unusual and wonderful means. You're going to love it, Samuel. That's what God means here. That, of course, is the note that will be struck years later, isn't it? On the night that God's king does finally emerge. That will be the angel's message to those shepherds in the fields. Fear not, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy. And I'm saying then God's message to Samuel here is along similar lines. All of which, of course, raises the question, how is God's mission to provide himself a king to defeat his enemy, restoring his creation for his own glory. How is that good news for Samuel? How is it good news for shepherds at Bethlehem? How is it good news? Well, this is how. Remember I said that on the day that Satan ruined God's creation, I said he did so by targeting the very noblest component of God's creation. He targeted man. He ruined creation by turning God's image bearer into a pale shadow of his former self, a wretched creature now, weighed down by guilt, horribly enslaved to sinful behavior and destined for everlasting hell. That's how Satan ruined God's creation. And that means then that God's enemy is only truly defeated and God's creation is only truly reclaimed and God's enjoyment and glory are only truly restored if for human beings there is forgiveness for their guilt and there is liberation for their enslavement and there is remission of their everlasting hell. And forgiveness and liberation and remission, therefore, are precisely what this king that God sent, Jesus Christ, secured. So yes, God's mission is about redressing his personal loss. That's crucial, I think, for us to understand. But wrapped up in him redressing his personal loss is salvation for human beings. There was that controversy recently about the meat byproduct, tallow, being in our £5 notes, and so vegetarians were up in arms and refusing to use £5 notes and all the rest of it. What does it mean that tallow is a meat byproduct? What does it mean that it's a byproduct? Well, it means then that the animal was not taken into the slaughterhouse in order to produce tallow. It was not taken into the slaughterhouse and put to death in order to produce tallow for our £5 notes. No, the animal was taken into the slaughterhouse and put to death to produce meat. But in the process, tallow is also produced. That's what we mean when we talk about it being a byproduct. And similarly then, God's mission is to deal with his enemy. That's his mission. But in the process, forgiveness and liberation and remission for sinners are produced. It's a byproduct, a glorious, wonderful byproduct. Now, I know there's a danger here of oversimplification, and of course the Bible stresses that God loves human beings and God wants human beings to be saved from their sins. Their salvation is not a byproduct in the sense that God doesn't really care much about it. It's a kind of take it or leave it thing as far as God is concerned. No. But nonetheless, when we strip things back to the Bible scale of priorities, this is what we find in the words of 19th century Robert Candlish, the recovery of mankind being made subservient to the completion of God's purpose of wrath against Satan. Our salvation wrapped up in what God is so determined to do to restore his own glory in his universe. So it's subservient, but it's real. In God's mission to advance his own cause through his own king, there is good news. Good news for Samuel. Good news for shepherds. Good news for you this morning. Perhaps you this morning, like Samuel in our text, are in the depths. Perhaps life for you seems shrouded in disappointments today. Relationship disappointments, educational disappointments, career disappointments, financial disappointments, family disappointments, health disappointments, whatever it may be. And perhaps at Christmas, when everyone seems to be so cheerful and happy around you, you're particularly conscious of these crushing disappointments in your life. And so, like Samuel, this morning you're feeling down, you're feeling raw. Well, God has a message for you this morning. And his message is, don't grieve. See how I have defeated my enemy through my king. And see how in that there is available for you this morning forgiveness and liberation and remission. And realize then that your disappointments are nothing. They are tiny alongside such glorious blessings. How long will you grieve? God is saying to you. Look away from your troubles this morning. Look to me, he's saying. Look to my king that I have provided. Trust in him. Bow to him. Serve him the rest of your days. Join my cause. Come onto my side. And as I restore my glory in this universe, and as I build toward the day when I will be all in all, salvation will be showered upon you. Come to me and come to my King. Listen to God's message this Christmas. Amen.